Member-supported Jazz 90.1 proudly welcomes you to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites. Call the show now at 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415 or soundbites.org. Now, alongside Steve Ray and Dave Enright, here's Nick Francesco on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Good afternoon, Mr. and Mrs. American, all the chips in the BC. It is Saturday,
the 20th of December, Anno Domini 2014.
So you still got a couple of days to buy those last-minute gifts. And you lucky people, you're listening to Soundbites. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And in 5 minutes after the hour, we're going to be bringing you news, views, things to choose, nothing to lose, kick off your shoes, don't get the blues. Here comes the news. Apple CEO Tim Cook has responded to an investigative report that revealed labor abuses at one of the company's Chinese suppliers, saying he is deeply offended by the allegations. In an internal email to UK employees obtained by The Telegraph, Jeff Williams, Apple Senior Vice President of Operations, wrote that both he and Cook are deeply offended by the suggestion that Apple would break a promise to the workers in our supply chain or mislead our customers in any way. The email was in response to a BBC documentary released this week, in which undercover journalists working at the Pentagon factory in Shanghai reported that workers there were subjected to long hours without breaks and under cramped living conditions. In the email, Williams said that the hour-long documentary implied that Apple isn't improving working conditions. Let me tell you, nothing could be further from the truth. He went on to say that the company provided the BBC with facts and perspective on its efforts to improve working conditions throughout its supply chain, but that input was clearly missing from their program, which, being British, they spelled wrong. The plant in question manufactures iPads and iPhones for Apple, which employs around 1,400 workers across China. The BBC reported that employees there were forced to work shifts that lasted up to 16 hours and that some worked 18 days in a row after their requests for time off were denied. One port reporter was made to share a small dorm with 11 other workers. Apple and other technology companies have come under increasing scrutiny in recent years for alleged labor abuses in their supply chains, most notoriously at plants owned by Foxconn. Last year, a labor rights watchdog accused Pegatron of committing safety and environmental violations at its factories, in addition to labor abuse allegations that are similar to what the BBC reported this week. In response, Apple has increased efforts to monitor and regulate its supply chain, as detailed in its annual supplier responsibility reports. In the internal email, Williams noted that the company has tracked the working hours of more than 1 million supply chain workers and that 93% comply with the mandatory 60-hour working week limit, though he acknowledged that there's room for improvement. We can still do better, and we will, he said. So our poll of the week at soundbites.org, that's bites with a Y, Francis would like us to remind you, is reported labor abuses at Apple China plant. Your choices are, I'm not surprised, I'll wait for the full report, I expected better of Apple, I don't care as long as I get my iPad mini. So far, we have 27 votes, and I'm not surprised is number one. Of course, I know you'll have more to say about this, so if you go to the forums, oh, I didn't put it in the forums yet, I'll do that shortly, you'll be able to talk a little more about that. I'm not surprised either, but not because of any animus toward Apple, but because Apple doesn't own those plants.
And it's better than other plants, because we went through this last year with another Foxconn plant. Yeah,
exactly. So I'm not entirely sure quite what the point of this is. I guess Apple has some sort of say over who works what, where, when, how, because Tim Cook is saying we're working on that and it's getting better.
Well, Apple can choose who they hire to right. build products. And so they can tell these companies that you have to follow these regulations or we won't put in our order for 60 million iPhones.
Right.
But the other half of the coin is it's not just Apple. Pretty much every tech company uses these same three or four manufacturers, but it's only seems that Apple is getting called out by the news.
Well, Apple has a particular reputation that they have themselves fostered over the decades.
Yeah. If it was Microsoft or Samsung doing it, no one would care.
Yeah. Mostly people would say, that's expected.
That's to be expected, Yep. Yeah, let's go to Korea and see some of the Samsung workers.
Yep.
But, although they probably offshore to China, too.
Yeah. But that's a part of it is that people expect Apple to be perfect, which is completely unrealistic. But Apple has themselves, in many ways, fostered that image of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess this is just their own chickens coming home to roost.
Yeah.
I suppose. Anyway, give us a call. 585-966-JAZZ.
Coming that's, to back to bite them in the butt.
That's 966-5299 or toll free 1-800-790-0415, just like Larry did from Rochester, New York. Welcome, Larry. What's up?
Good afternoon, guys. Good to hear you on the air again, and I am a supporter.
That's what I love to hear. What's up?
All right. Well, I have a Mac, as usual.
Yep.
And two questions. First of all, when I put the Mac to sleep, depending on how long it's been asleep and I come back to it, it seems like it's almost rebooting. And, you know, I've gone to some of the forums and some people say, yeah, I see that. But I never really get an answer to see is there a setting or something that I'm unaware of that I can set. And secondly, some programs seem to just close when it's been off long enough and you turn it on, you got to turn them back on again. Again, it's just something I'm missing.
Well, in general, when you put the computer to sleep, all of the applications in that are running go to sleep, and some applications don't sleep well. And we've seen cases where a running application will prevent a computer from going to sleep. Or if you're on a laptop and your battery drains completely while it's asleep, it goes into a super deep sleep. Sometimes it gets called hibernate, you know, deeper than sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And that can take longer to wake up again after sleeping.
Okay, this is an iMac.
Yeah, that doesn't change that.
There's no battery. Okay. That's a desktop.
Right, it won't have a battery, but the rest of it will be.
Right.
Now, does the iMac sleep well? Because I know that many desktop computers on the PC side do not sleep well. It's just not part of the circuitry in the motherboard. They don't actually sleep. Only laptops sleep. Is
yeah,
that true?
It's a little better in the Mac world. The generally the Mac desktops do sleep because Apple controls all the hardware, and so they can make sure it sleeps. Have you replaced anything inside the Mac, like the hard drive?
No, never. It's a relatively two-year-old machine, relatively new. But it's just kind of comical that you say sleep well. I guess in that sense, yeah, it does sleep well, probably almost too well.
It doesn't wake up.
when it doesn't want to wake up. And
yeah.
So I've just noticed, and so lately what I've been doing is turning it off and coming back in 15, 20 minutes and then putting it back to sleep and coming back in an hour or so. And there is a difference in the way it comes back up.
Do you see a progress bar coming across the screen?
Progress
when it's
bar.
Waking up, a little horizontal bar filling up as
oh,
it.
No, I don't see that. I only see that if I've actually turned the machine off or it's actually physically rebooted. But
yeah.
Just in a sleep mode, I never see that.
There is a safe sleep feature. But it looks like that only happens if you're booted from a solid state drive.
Oh, okay. I don't have a solid state drive here.
Sleep.
It's just something I had noticed lately. For some reason, and I was just wondering, is there something different about it? But it definitely comes up differently depending on how long it's actually been asleep. And as
right.
I said, if it's been off several hours and I come back in and turn it on for some reason, it almost seems like it's rebooting. Not completely, because I don't have that horizontal.
Well, that's something new in Yosemite, that the progress bar you see on startup.
Right.
They added to Yosemite. That used to be only in a diagnostic boot in previous OSs.
Okay.
So when we started seeing Yosemite boot, why is it doing a diagnostic boot? I didn't tell it to.
Okay. So that I see, but it's just that it does, there is a some difference. It
mm-hmm.
It doesn't stop it from working, and everything seems to function. It's just that I was curious why there is this difference in the way it comes up, depending on how long it's been asleep.
Right. If he sleeps long enough, will it go into hibernation?
Yeah, that's the deep sleep or the safe sleep. It will do that, and it uses even less power because there is a feature that they added, I think, in Mavericks called Power Nap. So even if the computer is sleeping, it can still install updates. So it's a light sleep. It's not a deep sleep.
Yeah.
And so after
a
while, it goes
saying,
into a deeper sleep.
Right. So
yeah.
If it's several hours, it may have now gone into that deep sleep.
Right.
That would make sense, then. I think somewhere in preferences, I believe.
There's a computer sleep and a screen sleep setting, but the deep sleep is handled by the OS after a while.
Okay.
And I don't think you can define what that while is.
Right. Okay, because I'm just looking in Saver, and it says computer sleep, and I have settings, and then display sleep, and I have checked put hard disk to sleep when possible, wake up for network access. I'm not quite sure what that means, but I guess when I bring it back up, it brings itself up so it'll have...
Right. Well, that's an administration function, so if the administrator of your network wants to install something on your computer, it can wake the computer up over the network.
Oh,
generally,
okay.
Home users don't need that.
Oh, we don't need it?
No.
Oh,
right.
So I can uncheck it?
Yeah.
Yeah, it almost doesn't matter because you don't have an administrator waking it over the Ethernet.
Oh.
Right.
Yep. Oh. Okay.
But it does save you from the possibility of someone starting your machine by sending it the proper wake-up signal and then maybe being able to do something on your machine.
Okay. So right now the wake-up signal is simply me coming and maybe pushing one of the keys on the...
Yep.
Keyboard or something like that, and then it snaps to again. It just takes longer if it's been off at some limit.
Right, and that's probably why, because it's reached that point where it goes into the deep sleep. Even though it was napping, now it's sleeping.
Oh, okay. We're almost talking about this thing like it's human.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Don't anthropomorphize computers.
They hate
that.
Okay. Well, thank you, guys. I think that answers my question. As usual, it's good to have you guys there for questions like this.
Thank you, Larry, and we very much appreciate you being a member.
Bye-bye.
Merry Christmas. Happy holidays.
And some people also notice that after a crash, it takes longer to boot.
Yes.
And we think that's why they added the progress bar on Yosemite, because it used to be just a little spinny gear thing that just spun. And it was one of those where you didn't know if it was stuck or if it was just taking a long time.
Right.
But now there's an actual bar that fills up. Well, it's a gray bar that fills up with a different shade of gray. we know every computer has a color monitor. You could have picked a better color.
Yeah.
And so it gives you more indication that it actually is working, and you can watch the progress bar fill up.
Right. All right. Before we go to the next call, because we probably don't have time before the break, would you hand me those, please? It is the last Saturday before Christmas.
And?
Which means that there's something very special here in the studio that we only... Oh, my God, that's heavy. And that tells me that's filled with
rum. Filled with rum.
This is it is Dave's Rum Balls Saturday, and I'm going to perform the experiment.
Go for
here
it.
Oh, my God, bringing it to my face.
Well, we don't have to drive for an hour and a half, so
right.
So it's an hour a shot to metabolize.
That is phenomenally good.
Thank you.
Oh, my.
And I haven't had a one. I like making them, but I don't eat them.
Oh, my. Oh, my, that's delicious. I apologize for the bad radio, but man, oh, man, these are good.
You can watch him on the camera enjoying himself.
That's right. These are delicious. Chocolate on the inside, powdered sugar on the outside, rum everywhere. They're very, wow.
And this is your 180 proof Antiguan rum?
This is, yeah, Antigua rum, and they've been sitting for... What, about 3 days now? 4 days, counting today.
Nice.
And believe it or not, there's no flour in them.
There's no room for flour in them. Holy
but they're fun
moly,
to make.
That's tasty.
They're fun to make, and my cousin Robin helped me last night.
Heck of a job, Robin.
At 8 o'clock at night, we're sitting there finally rolling the rum balls.
Very tasty. Very tasty. We should probably take a break. Tim, you're on the line. Stay on the line. We'll get to you in just a minute. We're going to take a quick break. Woo! Back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It is 19 minutes after the hour. You're listening to the longest-running computer show in the known universe, which is about to get a lot longer for me. It's Sound Bites on the member-supported Jazz 90.1.
computer talk you can understand. More Sound Bites is next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
At 23 minutes after the hour, we are Sound Bites, and we have Tim from Rochester, New York on the line. Welcome, Tim. What's up?
Hey, before we got started, I just need to ask if, given the presence of the Rumballs in the studio, am I going to have to call back next week and verify the advice I'm about to get?
No, we are prepared to give you.
You just got to call early this week.
Okay, I've been bad. I haven't upgraded my Windows XP machine because it was about 10 years old, and I just bought a new computer. I haven't set it up yet, in part because it has Windows 8.1 on it, and I went out and bought Windows 8.1 for Dummies, and I'm a bit intimidated by a book, a how-to manual that's about 1,000 pages long. So the first question is it that difficult? I understand you can set it up so that the user interface looks like Windows 7.
Right.
But other than that, is it that difficult to navigate? And,
no, absolutely not.
I do have Windows 7 at work, so
yeah, no,
I'm familiar
no.
with that.
There's really almost no difference. The big difference is that it's not Metro, modern. It's the modern interface, which is all those tiles that you see.
Yeah.
There's several ways to get past that. One of the tiles is labeled desktop. You click on it, you're on your desktop, just the way you always were. You can, on many machines, you can hit the Windows key or Windows, I forget, Windows something. Windows in like a C or a D or something, Windows
something
D.
Else.
And go to it. Also, you can, once you're at the desktop, you can set the desktop to be the permanent thing you go into. So all of those are possible, but whether you keep the modern front end or not, you can always get to the desktop. And once you're at the desktop, it truly is exactly like Windows 7.
Okay. And also, in terms of transferring my data, I do have an external hard drive. One of the things that I'm a bit concerned about, and I'm assuming that I'll be able to get the correct drivers, but it's an older external drive, and it has drivers for XP and Windows 7. Will I have to look for drivers for 8.1?
I wouldn't have expected any drivers at all.
Yeah.
It's a stock USB hard drive.
Yeah, if it's USB, you'll find it.
Yeah, the USB mass storage interface is standard and built in.
The theory is if you plug it in, Windows 8.1 will find it. Now, the only possible problem would be is if it comes up and says, this disk is not readable, do you want to format it?
Say
and
no.
And then you say yes. If you say yes, you're in trouble.
Yep.
Really, as long as you can avoid hitting the yes button, no worries.
Okay. And what about using cloud backup, like Carbonite, a tool like that?
Great products.
It's nice to have an off-site backup, in case of fire, flood, theft. You know, your computer and the hard drive sitting next to it are both destroyed. So it's nice to have that off-site backup. You can sort of do that yourself with two backup hard drives and just take one to work, so it's
right.
not at home. But yeah, having it automatically back up to the cloud with Carbonite or CrashPlan or one of the other cloud services is a nice way to do that.
Okay. And one final, I have two final questions. When it comes time to get rid of my old computer, what's a good disk wiping program?
DBAN.
DBAN.
Yep, Derek's Boot and Nuke.
It's a free download.
Pardon me?
It's called Derek's Boot and Nuke. DBAN, DBAN. DBAN.org. If you you download it, you burn it to a CD, you boot from that CD, and you're presented with a plethora of ways to wipe your hard drive, including stuff that's NSA acceptable. And, you know, it takes, you know, if you do it right, it takes days. right?
Yep.
But who cares? Set it up, let it run, a couple of days later, come back and turn it off, and it's done.
Yep. I know the last computer I had, it took about a day or two for it to do the complete wipe.
Right.
Yeah, because you don't just want to erase the drive.
Question,
you want to overwrite.
What is AskNick.com?
AskNick.com is on my list. I just retired a while ago, and then, of course, I taught four courses. So
you're busier
really,
now than before you retired.
Right. So I've really just retired. So after the holidays, I have it at the top of my list to bring back AskNick.
Okay, because I kind of miss being able to get the advice from that.
Well, thank
I was
you.
Even one of the willing paid members.
God bless you. You'll have that opportunity again, I promise you.
Okay.
All right, thanks.
Okay, thanks.
People have been very, very kind about Ask Nick. It's been down for a while. I want to redo it and make it right. It really kind of was, and then it wasn't. And I want to do it right, but I just have to have the time to sit down and do it. And now that I'm officially retired, post-holiday season.
No classes next semester?
I'll be good. I'm not taking any classes next semester.
Oh, good. We can talk. Cider would like you to come and speak at a meeting, but
I'm way too
you
busy.
Had classes on Wednesday.
Yeah, I did. I'd be happy to. I'd be honored to. I'm always available for speaking, particularly with the massive honorarium that I get, the mug. Yeah. I love the mugs.
We got new ones without periods.
Ooh.
We're no longer an acronym. We're
just a name.
We're just a name.
Oh,
yeah.
Very nice. I still have the old ones. I still have the one from Dan Rossica's old.
Yeah.
What was that
was
called?
MLS Online.
MLS Online. Yeah. Yeah.
Which was always hard.
Mac something.
Well, that Mac Cursor was Gabe Hamidian.
No, it wasn't Mac Cursor. Doggone it. I'll have to go look at it. It's a pen holder now, as most old mugs get to be after a certain point. But it was before MLS Online, Mac something. I don't
know. Max Last Stand.
Max Last
Well, that's what MLS is.
Yeah. Max Last Stand. Yeah. That was it. All right. Back to the phones. Our next caller is Karen from Brockport, New York. Welcome, Karen. What's up?
Oh, thank you for taking my question. I have a question and a funny news item later, and I'm a member also, just like your first caller.
Yay. Thank you.
So I have a Windows 7 PC. I upgraded it in the spring by adding a second hard drive for data only.
Right.
The dealer I took it to set up iTunes to download to and play from this new disk. Wednesday, I got an error saying I could not download anything else to the disk because it was full. I know I have a lot of things I can be deleting from iTunes because more than one podcast that I subscribe to has changed its name or its originating address. So iTunes, I know, has downloaded some duplicate stuff. I started deleting these duplicates, and I think I got some deleted, but eventually got an error saying there was not enough space available on that drive to delete. I'd never seen an error like that before.
Well, when you mark something for deletion, it goes to the recycle bin.
Right.
And stays there until you empty the recycle bin. So
okay, so that was the next part of my question. Where is the recycle bin when I'm deleting from the second hard drive?
On the second hard drive.
Oh, okay.
But it's the same icon on your desktop.
Okay.
Well, yeah, it's the same icon on your desktop. You just have to empty the trash. And if you actually looked in it, if you double-clicked on it, it would open up and you would see all the files that are in the trash. And I suspect you'll see a bucket load of iTunes files.
Now, do you download video or just audio?
Just podcasts.
Audio or video?
Audio.
Yeah, those are very small. So that I doubt that filled your hard drive.
Oh, okay.
There may be something else filling your hard drive.
Okay.
There is a free program called TreeSize, free, that will go through your hard drive and calculate the folder sizes of all of the folders and all the subfolders.
Okay.
And that will let you see where your big folder is. And so it may not be the iTunes directory. It may be something else.
Okay.
It may be iTunes. You're right. If you're downloading lots and lots and lots of stuff, and now never listening to it, never deleting it, then it would fill up. But
even audio files are 10 megs an hour, 20 megs an hour. They're very small. Right. Do you remember what size hard drive that second one was? Probably a terabyte?
Yes.
Yeah, that should be tens of thousands of podcasts.
Right.
Now, here's an interesting thought, though. What if the guy is saving them to the root directory? Then you can only have 511
Ouch.
Files.
Yeah.
Yep.
iTunes should put them in a folder.
Yeah, it should.
Should.
Optimum
but he may have,
word there,
he may
should,
have, yeah.
but...
He may have set it up to store at the root of the hard drive and not in a folder.
Karen, here's the deal.
Yeah.
When you save things to a folder, you can put as many files in that folder as you have space on the hard drive.
Mm-hmm.
But if things go right to the top directory in a on a drive, what's called the root directory, you can only put 511 files there. So if iTunes is actually saving to, let's say, your second drive is D colon. If it's actually saving to D colon backslash
nothing,
nothing else, yeah. then you can only have 511 files. And indeed, it thinks your drive is full, although you may have terabytes of disk space left.
Right.
So first, download tree size, install it on your C drive. Check your D drive with it and see how big your folders are, et cetera, et cetera. But if you don't find a big one, the problem may well be that iTunes is saving directly to the root directory of your D drive, and therefore you have plenty of space but can't use it.
Right, and you can check that out by opening that D drive on the desktop, and you'll either see a few folders or you'll see hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of files.
Okay.
Now, he should have set it up as NTFS, which doesn't have that limit, does it? I know FAT32 did.
Yeah, NTFS may. Now that you say that, I don't know.
But. Yeah, FAT32 is limited to 512 root entries. And that's actually a problem you see on some flash drives, because they're often formatted as FAT12. And so there's a 127 file limit. That's why digital cameras will put other files in a folder on the drive and not just at the root of the drive.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that's a couple of things that could be. It might be another folder is that full, or it may be that there's too many files at the root of the drive and there's a lot of free space that just the directory is full and it can't tell it to put any more files on it.
Okay, well, that's some stuff I can try, and then I can always take it back to the dealer.
Yep.
Ask them to explain what happened then, I guess.
Yes.
Okay, then the other sort of interesting, funny news I was going to share next time I called, that this actually happened back at the end of the summer. I was eating lunch in my kitchen one day, and the car that looked like the Google camera car went by several times around the neighborhood, but it had a Bing logo on the car.
Oh, interesting.
So I did not know and haven't heard anything about Bing doing a mapping thing.
Yeah, Bing has had maps for a while, when it used to be live.com, and they've been doing the camera cars. They also do airplanes. So Google has street view and satellite view. Bing has what they call a bird's eye view, which is an airplane that takes closer shots than a satellite, and so you get better looking houses. But yeah, it's kind of neat. Some people, if they can find the schedule of when those camera cars are going by, they'll put up a little display, like an Easter egg you can find on somebody's on the map if you look on the website, or you follow them down the road and you can make faces at the camera.
Yeah, right.
Yeah,
and people have done that. They've put. They've had sword fights. They've had everything. Name it.
And there've been a couple of them where someone thought they saw a murder happening. You know, someone lying on the ground, and then the next shot, they were in the trunk of a car. So there's a whole list of Easter eggs and hoaxes listed on Wikipedia too.
Right. And yes, there is a limit to the number of files you can put in the root folder on an NTFS volume, and it's 4 billion. So that's probably not the answer if it's an NTFS volume.
Right.
So at any rate, definitely try the tree size program and see what it tells you. It's a good place to start.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yep. Yeah. That's one of the things that used to catch people all the time on the old systems. And, of course, still... catches people on thumb drives.
Yep.
You can have a 32 gig thumb drive and all of a sudden it says it's full because you put everything in the root, and those are FAT32.
Yep. I've even seen some of them are FAT16 or FAT12.
Yeah, right, right.
Because they're you know, the 8-gig model, the 16-gig model, it doesn't need to be 32-bit because it's below 32-gig storage. It's a half a second to pick FAT32 instead of FAT16 when they make the drive.
I know. It is what it is. But you know what? Whatever you use, you should absolutely have backups. Karen is right to have stuff on a second drive. That's nice. Having it on a separate drive, the way Tim did is even nicer. And as Steve said, having it out on the cloud somewhere is really the best option. Having all of those is a good set of options because. If it's local, see, it's you can think of it in terms of proximity. If it's on your machine somewhere, if it's in two places on your machine, it's really fast and easy to bring back if you need to. If it's on a different drive on your machine, if it's on a different drive on your network, then it's almost as fast and easy to bring back. And if it's out on the network, it's maybe not quite as fast and easy to bring back. But also, if something catastrophic happens in your home, you're still in good shape because it's out there on the web. We're going to take a break. Back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco, and you. 39 minutes after the hour, Sound Bites, member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Online 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at soundbites.org. More with Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 44 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites, and we have Joanne from Greece on the line. Hiya, Joanne. What's up?
Problem with Gmail. I have Chromebook for Gmail.
Okay.
And when it spell checks fine. But then I go to change something, and it's starting to delete all the way ahead of what I'm writing. Is there something I need to check off to get rid of that?
So if you go to write something...
Yes.
Everything else to the right of the cursor all the way down the document disappears?
Yes, as I go along, everything in front of it.
Oh!
Replace rather than insert.
Right.
Yeah.
What's the key for that? On the keyboard, there used to be a key called insert. See, normally when you type a letter, it inserts it at the insertion point and pushes all of the other characters down.
Yes.
If you hit that insert key on the keyboard, it changes that to a replace function. So it replaces everything that that is in front of the cursor.
Okay.
And we are both frantically Googling to try to find out what that insert key is.
So it's something that's going on with the keyboard.
Yeah. Hold on a second. Let me figure this out. Well, that was wrong.
Insert and overwrite in Gmail. I found a blog.
I am using Gmail.
Yeah.
It's through the Chromebook.
We're trying.
Insert.
Because that's how you show me how to find
there's an insert key. So in the Google interface, is there an insert key button?
I'm looking at the shortcuts, insert versus overwrite. Okay. All right, we're frantically...
Okay.
What is it?
No, okay. Do you have a key on the keyboard called insert?
No, I have that keyboard right here. I'm on a Chromebook.
Because that that's on the extended keyboards you usually get on desktops in that little center editing area.
Right, but you're in a Chromebook, right?
No, I'm actually on my desktop with my full keyboard.
Okay, then on that particular keyboard in near the upper right...
Yeah, there is an insert thing.
Right. So click that and then try typing something. Click it again and try typing something, and you should see the two differences.
Okay. It did work. It did. So if I have something to spell, I just put insert and then start typing.
Well, yeah, you probably want to leave it in insert mode so it always inserts what you're typing because that's the way we're used to it. You probably accidentally, or do you have a pet that stepped on that key and turned overstrike mode
or
on?
Or fat fingers.
No, I do lay stuff on it, though.
There you go.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay.
Shift and caps lock may do that on the Chromebook.
Well, because you got me to use Chromebook because of my Google, Microsoft was not spell checking. So going through Chromebook, I got the spelling going right.
Right.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Good luck. Let us know if that doesn't work.
Okay. Thanks.
Thanks.
There may even be a light on the insert function that to show you're in insert versus overstrike. Or a flag on the Google page to show you you're in insert versus overstrike. A couple of references I saw said shift and caps lock on the Chromebook keyboard will turn you into overstrike
Except,
mode.
Except, of course, there's no caps lock on the Chromebook keyboard.
Oh, it's a search.
It's a
search icon where the caps lock usually is.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's no insert light here, of course, that I'm seeing, but...
Yeah, so it's probably not a Google function. It's an OS function in the keyboard. So if she went to another program, it would do the same thing.
Exactly.
And she only notices it in Mail.
Right. Because that's all she's doing it with. Right. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Walter, also from Greece, New York. Welcome, Walter. What's up?
Happy holidays to all of you folks.
And happy New Year to you. And to you.
Thank you. The reason I'm calling is that... I use Linux, Ubuntu 12.04, and I'm finally convinced to go and try use cloud storage for backup.
Yep.
And it took me a while to find one that I feel confident with a company. But I have a few questions kind of that relate to that.
Sure.
Okay. First off, I had been using Back in Time for my backups. And I kept them on different hard drives, thumb drives, and had them in FireSafe and other places. And that's why I'm finally going to the cloud.
Right.
But one of the things that I found interesting is that when I went to the folder that I made on the hard drive, in Nautilus, it tells me the one folder for mine is 254 megabytes. But yet when I use the DU, the disk utility command,
right,
I end up with 719. And do you think it's because DU goes ahead and actually goes back, you know, instead of using the links that... That back in time uses, that actually goes back to the other directories?
Right. You have it exactly. Back in time actually creates multiple directories.
Okay.
And what DU is showing you is all of those actual directories with real files in them. What back in time is showing you is your latest one.
Okay. Interesting part then I then did is that I was looking at my home directory, again with DU, and looking at the back in time, it was the 719 megabytes. When I actually then went into DU at my actual home folder, it said it was 627. So that 627 megabytes. So I'm confused even by that.
There are flags in DU. Is one of them file size versus allocation size?
Right. I use the command DU space dash SH. And then the home directory that I put in, my / home / username.
Yeah.
And for both of them. That's what
uppercase
I came up with.
Or lowercase s?
Yes, lowercase s.
And uppercase or lowercase h?
Lowercase h.
All right, lowercase h is human readable. Uppercase h is follow the symbolic links.
Okay.
Right. So make sure you're using the lowercase h and of course, the lowercase minus s. Is summarize. Now,
okay.
What you might try is see if they match by doing an uppercase S, because that says don't follow subdirectories.
Okay. All right. Very good.
I have one final
question then on the backups.
Yeah.
Like I said, I could make the backup onto the hard drive that I'm using, and then I'm thinking to export even that into the cloud storage, or does that not make sense? Because I'd be having all of my data, et cetera, just going right into the cloud storage. I get, with the one I'm considering using, I get 15 gigabytes free.
Yeah.
And, you know, does it make sense to put my back in time backup into the cloud storage?
No, it doesn't. If you're already saving your files up there, saving them up there twice to the same place doesn't make a lot of sense.
Okay. Very good.
There you go.
All right, well, thank you again. You've been very helpful.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Bye now.
Bye. Go ahead.
I'll say that goes back to what we were talking earlier about having an off-site backup in addition to a local backup. We get some customers that only have an off-site backup, which is okay, until you need to restore a lot of files, and then it takes hours and hours and hours or days to download all your files again. So it's a good idea to have a local backup for speed and an off-site backup for security.
Right. And of course, the real issue is that you use the offsite backup in case of some sort of catastrophic failure
right.
in your area, but you use the local backup for the day-to-day, oh, I didn't mean to delete that file or whatever
yep.
it happens to be.
And if you have a friend that you can trust, a service called CrashPlan has a really cool free option where you back up to your friend's hard drive. And theoretically, they back up to your hard drive. So it's cloud backup storage off-site on someone else's hard drive for free. You just have to trust them because theoretically, they could see your files. They are
right.
encrypted, but theoretically, they could see them.
Right. All right. We have time. Yeah, we have time. Back to the phones. Our next caller is David from Leroy, New York. Leroy or Leroy?
I say Leroy.
Because you're in Leroy.
That's correct.
Yeah, my wife is from Leroy, and when she's in Rochester, this is true. When her family still lived in Leroy, when she was in town, she said Leroy. When she was in Leroy, she said Leroy.
Is that like chili and chili?
No, not at all like that. It's just so weird. Anyway, what's
Avon
up, David?
Avon and Avon.
Well, good afternoon, guys.
Good afternoon.
I had a situation recently that I wanted to share. I have a 2009 Mac Mini. With 8 gigs of RAM, and I replaced the optical drive so that I'm running off of a solid-state drive. It runs real fast now.
Yeah, I bet.
And I decided to go ahead and buy Parallels so I could run a copy of Windows. So I have Parallels 9, which is the version before Yosemite came out, and I bought a copy of Windows 7 on eBay. Now, I've been a Mac user since about 85, 86, so I've really never bought Windows before.
Right.
And I ran into a situation where everything loaded beautiful. It ran real fast on the Mac Mini, but it wouldn't authenticate.
Yep.
So I tried to, you know, use the authentication program that says it's not a legal copy. So I chatted with one of the Microsoft people, and then he explained to me the difference between buying an upgrade version, which I paid like $65 for, versus an OEM.
A full version, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm out $65. I just, you know, Mac software is not like that, so I'm not used to having to worry about what version.
The other problem you run into is that a lot of the stuff on eBay has already been activated by somebody else, and now you cannot activate it because someone else already did.
Well, this
so in essence, it's a fraudulent sale, which is a huge problem on eBay.
Well, this one was, it guaranteed that didn't happen, but it clearly says on the disc that it's supposed to be used on a Dell computer, but it didn't register with me because, well, I've never had to worry about a machine versus its operating system.
Yeah, that's the other issue with Windows discs, that some of the discs are encoded for a specific brand of computer, and then you have upgrade discs that require a previous operating system already, and then you have retail versus OEM. So a retail disc is what you would buy in the store. The OEM disc is what Dell and HP buy to pre-install on computers. And typically when you're building your own machine, which in essence you are, you have to use a retail full install disc, which is the most expensive, of course.
Right. And that is labeled OEM?
No, that's retail.
It's labeled retail.
Yeah.
Right.
OEM is specific to
a particular manufacturer.
Right.
I see. Well, that's what I need.
Well, sometimes you can get generic OEM discs. That's what we got in our store. So a generic OEM disc, it's not supposed to be sold by itself. It's supposed to be sold with the hardware.
So
somebody somewhere is violating their OEM license by selling you the disc by itself.
Oh, there's a whole lot of people out there.
They usually get around that by throwing in a mouse. You know, a cheap USB mouse for a buck, and now we're including hardware, so that's in the spirit of the OEM law.
Actually, that is the OEM law. You can as long as you're selling hardware as well.
Hardware is intended to mean a computer with a hard drive in it.
Says though,
right?
So you can buy with just the hard drive too.
Okay, so I'm going. I do want to buy a legitimate copy of Windows.
Good for
you. It needs to be the retail version. Would there be any advantage to having, if I'm a casual user of Windows, having 7 Pro versus 7 Home version?
As a casual user, it is unlikely you will use the abilities of Pro unless you want to network with someone else.
I do not.
Then it's unlikely that you will ever run into a situation where you will need Pro.
And that will save you a little money because you can get Home Premium instead.
Yeah, right. That's like $100 versus $140 or something for the other. So,
right.
I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, guys. Well, that's what I really wanted to say. And thank you very much. And Merry Christmas.
You too. Good luck.
All right. Bye-bye.
Steve Jobs actually made fun of Microsoft in one of the keynotes when he introduced a new version of Mac and Mac OS. And the upgrade version is you know, $100. The full version is $100. The server version is $100.
Yes.
We don't have 27 different versions of Mac OS like they do Windows OS.
Well, Microsoft does not want you to buy a second-hand copy of any of their stuff.
Right.
Yep.
They don't make money when you do that. So, not only, and that's something that's coming back to bite them in a big way, and that's one of the reasons they're changing the way they do some things, is because with so many different versions available and with so many different options and with, you know, not just Windows Home, Windows Home Premium, blah, 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 but OEM versions and generic OEM versions and full retail versions and everything else, there are dozens upon dozens of versions of Windows that you can buy. And the average user doesn't understand the difference. And so when they buy the wrong version,
especially on an online store,
right, they get angry with Microsoft.
Yeah, so if you go to a physical store, they probably could have helped you with the right version,
right.
But it would have cost more,
right?
Because it was the right version.
Right, exactly. All right, we are going to take a break. You've wasted an entire hour of your life with this nonsense, but you know what? Because you're a slow learner, you get to do it again. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, with Steve Ray, with me, Nick Francesco, and you. It is 59 minutes after the hour. You're listening to the longest-running computer show in the known universe. We are Soundbites, and we are right here on the truly great and solely member-supported, and thank you for your support, Jazz 90.1. See you on the other side for a whole nother hour of this nonsense, whether you like it or not. Stay right there. We'll be right back.
It's America's longest-running computer show. Back to more sound bites with Nick, Dave, and Steve. Next on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Welcome back to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites, on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Get online now. Call 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415. Or submit your question by email at soundbites.org. Once again, here's Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 4 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites. Now, before we get back to the phones, I get a lot of people asking me questions on both Google Plus and Facebook about this. Let me make things clear. I've been talking about Greenlight.
Mm-hmm.
Greenlight Networks is coming.
Have another rumble. Settle you down.
Greenlight Networks, for those of you who've been hiding under a rock, is fiber to the home, 100 megabits or a gigabit to the home. Very nice. They're doing my neighborhood now, but they are just in the process of actually doing my neighborhood. We don't have it yet. Stop asking me how it is, because I don't know yet.
And they're going to go right by your house. You know.
Well, yes,
you're going to be the last one.
Yes.
They will purposely start at the other end of the street.
No, the first house is my next door neighbor.
And then they're jumping over
right
you.
Right away, and then they'll jump over me and do the folks on the other side. So please stop asking me how good it is, because I don't know yet, and that just makes me angry. And believe me, as soon as I know, you'll know. It won't be a secret. I'm so looking forward to it, but I don't have it yet. I was actually looking at a video online, and I never look at these videos because they're just an hour-long commercial from the Motley Fool. And they're an investment thing, but they actually talked about fiber to the home and how it's the new disruptive technology, and how it really is a game changer.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things they said was you could watch a full HD movie and simultaneously record seven more without any stutter.
Ooh. This is going to make some of the
Think about that.
It's going to make the other boys in here in town, especially one, rethink.
Yep.
Well, one of them, there was this CEO, I think, or CFO. One of them said that our customers have said they don't want, you know,
They don't want internet. High speed.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. We don't want a high price is what we don't want.
Yeah. Right.
The thing that is, though, is because they keep threatening the caps and all this, you know.
Yep.
Limitations and throttling down and everything else. And as we've been talking about for quite a few months now, is more and more folks, you know, since the cable companies wouldn't allow you to pick and choose what you want to watch on TV, you know, as far as selecting your package, you can do that now on the computer and stream it right from your laptop to your big TV. So you're watching it on a big screen, high def, and you pick and choose, and you can watch it on your time.
Although you have to be a little careful, because enough of those $8, $9, $10 a month Netflix and Hulu and CBS and HBO, you're going to end up paying more than you would have bundled on the cable.
Right. Well, but now here's the interesting part, is Time Warner has recently said they are going to raise our rates again. We're getting an extra fee. I think it's $3 a month for the sports packages. Whether you like it or not, you're getting the sports packages, and whether you like it or not, you're going to pay this extra $3 a month. Plus, they're raising the regular fees because it just costs so much to have them. On the other hand, ESPN and about everybody else has their own set of packages, some of which are free outside the home area of the team.
You know, watching it on the computer is getting to be more and more.
Yep.
I know people who have purchased a Chromebook, a couple of $100, just to have a second device they can watch television on while they're doing other stuff.
Just hook it right up to my 55-inch screen?
Exactly. Yep. Or
HDMI
in this case,
cable?
People Chromecast it.
Yeah. HDMI cable right to it.
Yep. And
boom. Or HDMI right to it. Exactly right. And they're watching everything that they want to watch, and it works. All right, anyway, back to the phones. Our next caller is Joe from Cheektowaga. There you go. What's up, Joe?
Well, golly, I got my bill electronically last night, and I thought, oh, golly, sports, I don't even watch sports. I might listen to it on the radio, like the Bills or the Sabres or something, but gosh, now I'm going to be paying for sports. Did you see that? The digital adapters going from 99 cents to 275? I mean, that's 178% increase.
It's technically not a rate increase, so they don't have to ask the Public Service Commission.
Right.
It's an equipment fee, so they can do whatever they want. A lot of people are buying their own cable modems because of that.
Actually, about 6 months ago, they said, oh, well, we're not getting enough money. We'll create this broadcast TV fee.
Right.
Oh, isn't that nice?
Right. And the simple reality, it's not that they aren't making money. And this is not just true of our local cable provider, by the way. This is all cable providers. It's not that they aren't making money. They don't feel they're making enough money. Billions of dollars a quarter is not enough for them. Anyway, what's up? What's up, Joe?
Well, let's see. Going a bit back in the program, I have to caution people about taking their backups to work. I will relate
some
one thing that
check with work.
Well, one thing is check with work, and two, you have to kind of feel out what the atmosphere is there, because I got laid off from a job where basically they took me into a conference room and explained, you're not working here anymore. They had someone else go to my desk to retrieve any, you know, things that were personal and whatever, you know, in a little box, and escorted me to the door. Right. That was an obviously high security sort of job I had. So if your backup is sitting anywhere in the building that's, like, not at your desk, like maybe you stuck it in a systems room or something because it has all that nice, you know, fire suppression and all that,
right?
It might be a bit difficult to retrieve what's yours. So unless you own the place, I can't highly recommend taking your backup to work. You really got to work it out with them.
Very good point.
That's one thing. The other thing, DU is an exceptionally complex program.
Yeah, it is.
The thing your caller might have been seeing is the difference between SI units and powers of two units.
Yeah, and I was also wondering allocation space versus block size. So like a 3K file will use 3K, but it will take one 4K block. And so when you do it one way, it says 3K. You do it another way, it says 4K.
That's exactly right. 4K is a typical block allocation size for Linux file systems. There's also the phenomenon of sparse files, where the DIP file system is clever enough to store strings of zeros that span more than one file allocation unit.
Right.
As just a note, hey, skip a block here. So DU will actually, it stands for disk usage, so it's actually what you're using on the disk. So there's that too, that if you have files that have a bunch of zeros in them, DU will show you less because it's actually taking less disk space.
I usually use DF and then put the minus H for human readable.
Right.
That gives you, you know, much, much higher level capacity rather than showing you each individual file size.
Well, DF only shows you file systems at a time, though.
Yeah.
It will show you partitions or whatever else, logical volumes if you're into that, or complete disks. The other interesting thing that the guy that was talking about it, OEM versus retail version. I bought my computer, please don't laugh, back in 2003. It's still running.
Oh, yeah.
But I wanted to play around with virtualization, so I got QEMU working on it. This is cute. It'll boot DOS. It'll boot Linux, install Linux on a virtual disk. Then I took the Windows 2000 disk that came with my computer. And I said, use the CD drive as the boot drive in QEMU. And the very first thing it spits out is, this OEM copy of Windows can only be run on a Dell.
Yeah.
Yes, it's running on a Dell. It's not my fault. You can't tell it's running on a Dell, darn it.
Right.
We need flag inside the emulators to say what model brand computer you're on.
Right, but that's
I'm going to guess it was reading the BIOS ROMs bytes somewhere, you know, looking for a Dell signature.
Right,
mm-hmm. Most likely.
That's exactly what it's doing. Either that or a separate chip.
Oh, all right.
In the boot up, it could have been on the motherboard. Yeah,
it could have been part of the ACPI configuration.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. One of those things.
Yep.
All right. Well, thank you for your time, gentlemen.
There you go, Joe. Have fun. Have a great Christmas.
You have a great Christmas, too.
I intend to. Thanks.
That's a huge problem when you're looking to buy your own copy of Windows or you're looking to virtualize a second Windows. Some of the versions of the Windows are not licensed for virtualization. We've run into that in the Mac world, that some of the versions of the Mac are not licensed for virtualization. So the virtualization programs know that and won't let you break the license.
Right.
But the difference between the OEM, the generic OEM versions and the OEM specific versions, and then the retail versions, and it's just impossible for an average user to know what they're doing.
Right. And the other thing Joe touched on is, if you move from Windows to Linux, you find programs like DU and DF and LS and CAT, and you think, well, there's a direct substitute for directory or type or whatever. But the Linux commands are much, much, much more powerful than the equivalent Windows commands, and you just need to learn a little more about them.
DIR, command not found.
Right. Although you can alias it in your bash.rc.
LS-AL, that's what I use.
Right, exactly right. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Marianne from Irondequoit, New York. Welcome, Marianne. What's up?
Hi. I have a question on that Derek's boot in Nuke.
Yep.
What you had said to the fellow about downloading it to a disk.
Yep.
Jump drive would do the same thing?
I think it will install on a jump drive. I don't honestly know that.
Let's take a look. That would be faster than burning it to a CD. It could boot faster and run faster.
But
can I ask you this? When I download something from the internet, it goes right to my download folder on the C drive.
Right. Yeah. We misspoke. After you download it, you would install it to a bootable CD or a bootable flash drive.
Okay, you would install it to there. So how would you do that? What would you?
You run the program that gets downloaded. Uh-huh. And it will, I think, and we're looking at the instructions now, it will let you or talk you through either burning it to a CD or writing it to a flash drive.
Oh, after it's downloaded. Okay. And then you mentioned that you would boot the computer from that drive. Can you do it from a USB drive? Can you boot your computer from that?
Most machines will let you do that. You have to make a change in the BIOS to do that, however.
Or sometimes, nowadays, most of them you can hit like F12.
Yeah, if you can see on your startup screen, there's often, when you very first turn on the computer, there's something that says hit F12 for the boot menu, or F9 or F11
and
or escape.
If jump drive plugged in, it will then allow you to select that USB drive to boot from.
In other words, when you turn on your computer...
Mm-hmm. Oftentimes, there's a hit delete for setup, hit F12 for the boot menu. There are messages that come up at the bottom of the screen with different keys you can press to do different things.
Okay, and it'll say that you can boot from the USB or...
Right, well, one of the options will say boot menu, and that will bring up a menu of what to boot from, the hard drive, the CD drive, a USB drive.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
Okay, so you can boot from a USB drive then.
Give it a shot, yes.
Okay, yeah, I've got a 16 gigabyte USB. That should be enough to hold that, right?
Probably more than enough, yeah.
Okay, and then one other question. Once you do this to your computer, are you able to install another operating system or a new one?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yep.
Yeah, what this does is it securely erases all the data on the drive so that an unerase program can't get it back. So normally when you throw something in the recycle bin and then empty the recycle bin, the file is still on your hard drive somewhere. It's just the directory.
Yeah, the bit has been turned off, so it's not visible.
Yeah, it doesn't know where it is, but it's in there somewhere.
It knows it's a usable space again.
Yeah, but there are programs that typically police and forensic recovery companies use to un-erase files because they are still really on the disk.
Right.
So what this D-band does is it overwrites all of the data on the disk with ones and N0s, probably ones and N0s and zeros, ones and N0s again. So it overwrites it several times to make sure there is nothing on the disk that can be unerased by anybody.
Uh-huh.
So a lot of people use that when they are giving their computer to someone because they don't want the data to be recoverable. If you're just going to erase your drive to install another OS for yourself, you can just use the Windows disk erase.
Right. Now, if it does go to someone else, though, do you need, like, your original disk to reinstall Windows?
Yeah, absolutely.
Or you have to buy brand new disks, which we've been talking about today. It's very hard to get the right disk to buy.
Right, uh-huh. Right. Uh-huh. Well, it probably would be, like, a Windows retail disk I'm thinking of.
Yeah, and that generally a full Windows retail disk is about $100.
Right, uh-huh. Okay. All right. Now, when you install that, you would do it from the from a disk,
from
right?
A CD disk, usually. Yep.
And all you do is turn it on, put it in, and it'll recognize it.
No, you have to go to the boot menu and tell it to boot from the CD.
I see.
Okay, we got to take a break.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Back in just a couple of minutes with Dave, Steve, Nick, you, 20 minutes after the hour, Soundbites, member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Computer talk you can understand. More Soundbites is next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And 24 minutes after the hour, we have Steve from Greece on the line. Welcome, Steve. What's up?
Well, good afternoon, gentlemen. Happy holidays. Merry Christmas.
You too. You too.
I have a couple questions. The first is about a USB for booting your computer. The ISO file, if you only have, in other words, can you have more than an ISO file on a thumb drive and the computer just sees the ISO file?
No, you can't have an ISO file on a thumb drive. You have to use the contents of the ISO file to make a bootable drive.
Okay.
So the ISO is basically an image of a bootable drive.
Right.
And so you take that image and make a bootable drive out of it. It doesn't work if you just copy the ISO file to the external drive.
Okay. Same way,
so
it wouldn't work.
Should be the only thing on a thumb drive.
But you can have a partition. You can have multiple partitions with different boot volumes on each partition.
Okay. Yeah, that's trickier, but doable. It's the same thing that you would have with a CD itself. You can't just put the ISO on the CD. You have to install the ISO to the CD, which makes it bootable, which lets you boot from it. And the same is true of a thumb drive.
Okay, sounds good. My last question, or maybe my last question, we'll see. I've heard about WebRTC for browser and voice stuff, but I don't. It's new to me. I've never... PC World has mentioned being able to talk and video and stuff. We're seeing WebRTC, and I was wondering if you knew anything about it.
Yeah, the RTC stands for real-time communication, and it's essentially voice calling, video, chat, file sharing, P2P stuff, et cetera, et cetera.
Skype and Google Hangouts.
Skype and Google Hangouts, yeah. Essentially, is how that is what that is. The only reason you need to know about WebRTC these days is if you're writing something. If you're just using it, as long as you have a new version of Chrome or Firefox, WebRTC is built in. It's implemented in both Chrome and Firefox as of last year. Certainly the latest version, certainly. Also, I'm...
And Opera.
Opera, definitely.
But not Safari.
Not Safari and not Internet Explorer. But if you really want to use WebRTC to its fullest, Chrome or Firefox.
And what would I do with it? I mean, I don't understand.
You would use that instead of Skype or instead of Google Hangouts.
And it is video also. It's not just...
It's video and audio and file sharing and a bunch of other things. But what WebRTC is like HTTP. It's a protocol for doing those things, just like HTTP is a protocol for getting a web page on your computer.
Right.
You still have to go someplace that uses that to do something. So, for example, YouTube uses WebRTC. GoToMeeting uses WebRTC. Google Hangouts uses WebRTC, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So WebRTC is just a protocol. It's like a bus.
Right.
It's the bus, but what's important is the destination.
Okay. I wanted to Skype three-way, but if you Skype three-way, it costs money.
Yep.
I'm wondering if I could use WebTC to get the three-way effect of...
Yes, and you would use that by running Google Hangouts, which will let you connect up to a total of 10 people for free.
All right, excellent. Thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate it.
There you go.
You're welcome.
Yeah, we have to understand the difference between the protocol and the use of that protocol. The protocol is the way to do it, is how to do it. The program is what you do it with. So Skype and Google Hangouts Both use WebRTC and a couple of other technologies.
Although, a little bit annoyingly, they both use WebRTC, but they're not interchangeable with each other.
Right.
So you can't use Skype to connect to Google Hangouts and vice versa.
Right.
Same thing with Apple's FaceTime. You know, it only works with FaceTime. It doesn't work cross-platform. Back in the chat-only days, text-only chatting, we used to have Adium, which supported dozens of different chat protocols from MSN and AOL and ICQ and everybody.
Right.
But now video chatting is the more common method now. And
they are not interoperable.
Yeah, and there hasn't been a single program that works with multiple or any or all of the video chat clients.
Right. Now, I should say that I believe Skype lets you do a third person now.
That's what I'm checking for group calling.
Right. And if as long as one person is paying for it, you can get more than that. But
up to
definitely
25 people.
Yeah. But definitely Google Hangouts is up to 10 people video chatting together. Now, you better have a fairly fast internet connection. I will have that.
Yeah. So Skype allows 25 people for free.
Maybe.
25 people that already have Skype.
Audio.
Audio, no, and video. If you want to add someone on a landline, you have to pay. But if it's Skype to Skype to Skype to Skype to Skype, you can do that for free now.
Oh, nice.
And 25 users. I'd hate to see the bandwidth that would take.
Yeah.
Well, because Google offers 10, so they have to offer more.
Well, exactly.
Yeah.
All right.
One up.
Back to the phones. Our next caller is Roy from Pittsford, New York. Welcome, Roy. What's up?
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I got a couple questions that may relate back to older machines, but might be on my new machine. I have a Windows 7 Professional, and the old machine, well, never mind what they are, but they're Windows machines.
Right.
There was one program in the boot up that allowed you to select different types of boot up, like safe mode and what have you.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a mode there that allows you to go through the startup step by step.
Yeah.
I remembered that from a past machine, but I don't know if I have it on Windows 7.
You don't any longer, as far as I know. I certainly haven't seen it.
That was in that F8, and that was one of the options at the bottom.
Right. Yeah. And they got rid of that. That doesn't quite work anymore.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. So that's why I can't find it, I guess.
That's the reason.
Okay, I got two more quick questions. The second one relates to that. There is another program available apparently on the web that allows you to load that program and do the same thing.
Right.
It can delay the startup or stop the startups or what have you.
Right.
What is the name of that program?
Yeah, that's a very good question. we may have to get back to you on that one.
Yeah. What's your next question?
The last question was, and this relates to my machine, it's a Dell XPS 8300.
That's okay. Just go ahead.
And it has to do with the post beeps.
Mm-hmm.
When it gives a beep for a RAM failure, I wonder if that would include a C drive failure.
Not usually. Usually those post beeping are noises that are actually coming from the motherboard, letting you know that there's a failure there, not necessarily anything to do with the hard drive.
But it could be the SATA controller on the motherboard.
Okay.
And you'd have to look in the manual for the computer to see what the beep patterns
but
mean.
But usually, on a hard drive, you'll hear a clacking.
Yeah.
You'll hear it knocking. I mean, usually when a hard drive's going, you'll hear the stators slapping up against the little stopper that's in there, and you'll hear it going click, 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 because it can't read the data because it had a head crash.
I agree. I had that several years ago on a machine at work.
So usually the post beeps, though, are primarily to the motherboard.
Okay.
Yep.
All right. Now, where could you get back to me on that program name?
I'm not seeing a program that does that.
Oh.
For XP it was available, and for Vista it was available.
It probably is not going to work anymore because of the different BIOSes and changes to
the
app
system. You can enable the boot log that gives you a file that shows you all of the drivers that were running during startup.
Yeah, right.
But I don't see a way to step through each driver one by one.
Yeah.
Yeah, unfortunately, they seem to have taken that out, which was a fairly stupid thing to do.
Well, I'm talking about this other program now. I agree with you that apparently it's not in the BIOS or whatever.
Right, and that's what we're saying. We can't find it because there might be issues as far as stepping through that any further now.
Well, that could be. I remember what it did was you ran it once.
We know what it did, but it, you know, it's just not available any longer.
Right, and we haven't been able to find a third-party program that puts that back in.
Right.
Okay.
All right.
I guess it's gone forever.
There you go.
For now, anyway.
Sorry. Yeah, yeah, for now.
Thank you, gentlemen. Have good holidays.
Merry Christmas.
Bye.
Yeah, it's sadly when they made Windows 7, they took that away, and it is likely because of the way they redid the entire boot up sequence. It doesn't do things step by step anymore. It does things in tandem. Unix, which means both Linux and the Mac, have for many years booted things simultaneously. So while it's loading, for example, the GUI, which takes so long, it's also in the background loading many other things, which is why non-Windows machines booted up so fast in the past.
Mm-hmm.
Windows picked up on that and is now doing that parallel boot thing, but that means you can't do step-by-step anymore.
And a step-by-step was kind of left over from DOS mode, where you would type one command and it would run. You type the next command and it would run. So you couldn't do things at the same time. You had to do them in sequence.
Well, and, you know, it's just another feature that if they don't have to program it into the chip,
right,
it's one less thing that they don't have to worry about. And is it going to work correctly with this particular video card versus the sound? I mean, there's so many different peripherals now that you can add to your machine and things that are built onto the board. Trying to get this, even this boot drivers, you know, it says it's a very simple program to go through, but it can cause issues when booting it, going through that step by step.
And you can kind of mimic that by using msconfig, turning everything off or just turning some things on and off.
Mm-hmm.
So it limits what runs.
Exactly.
And then you turn if that fixes the problem, you turn the next one on and try to boot. And if that fixes the problem, turn the next one on and try to boot.
Exactly. One at a time.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
All right. Our next caller is Henry from Brighton, New York. Welcome, Henry. What's up?
Hi. Yeah, I have a question that actually relates to what you've just been talking about. My question is really rather simple. What is the difference between Windows 7 Professional and Windows 7 Premium, or Home Premium, as they call it?
Networking. Basically networking.
Networking and security.
You can connect to a domain with Windows Pro, and a domain is something that large corporations use. Most home users use a work group. And so you can share among your work group, but you can't connect it to a domain. The domain gives the IT staff a lot more control over your computer.
Where you can go and what you can do.
Okay. Because I actually have two computers at home here, and I'm using Premium on one and Professional on another.
Mm-hmm.
But the comment I'd like to make is that on the Premium edition that I have noticed, I did a restore recently, and when I pressed F8 or delete, whatever, it came up with a long menu of options, one of which appeared to me, I'm just recalling this by memory now, that you had the option of doing a step-by-step boot, where it did what DOS used to do, where it would go step-by-step. Now, maybe I'm wrong.
Oh, interesting. I have not seen that. Okay. I will look for it. What was it you did to make that come up?
I believe I pressed either F8 or delete.
There's an advanced
at the very beginning of the boot-up process.
Yeah, there's an advanced troubleshooting mode. And that's where you can turn on the debug log, but I don't remember seeing that step-by-step boot.
It's possible that that's what I saw, that it was a debug log as opposed to a step-by-step.
Right, but I will look.
Yeah.
Thanks.
All right, thank you.
Yep, bye-bye. Yeah, there are so many versions of Windows now, and there are so many options for all those.
Windows actually calls those editions.
Right.
So the version 7 has 6 editions.
Right.
And so when you multiply that out by the number of versions and the number of editions.
And the number, and then subdivide those editions into OEM versus full.
Yep. There's a Wikipedia article that just goes on forever describing all the different versions and the different editions.
Yeah. Yeah, lots of that stuff. Pretty amazing. Well, let me read another news article. This is just so nice. German researchers have discovered security flaws that could let hackers, spies, and criminals listen to private phone calls and intercept text messages. on a potentially massive scale, even when cellular networks are using the most advanced encryption now available. The flaws, which will be reported at a hacker conference in Hamburg this month, are the latest evidence of widespread insecurity on SS7, the global network that allows the world's cellular carriers to route calls, texts, and other services to each other. Experts say it's increasingly clear that SS7, the first design, which was first designed back in the 80s, is riddled with serious vulnerabilities that undermine the security of the world's billions of cellular customers. The flaws discovered by the German researchers are actually functions built into SS7 for other purposes, such as keeping calls connected as users speed down highways, switching from cell tower to cell tower, that hacker can repurpose for surveillance because of the lax security on the network. Those skilled at the myriad functions built into SS7 can locate callers anywhere in the world, listen to calls as they happen, or record hundreds of encrypted calls and texts at a time for later decryption. There also is potential to defraud users and cellular carriers by using SS7 functions, the researchers say. These vulnerabilities continue to exist, even as cellular carriers invest billions of dollars to upgrade to advanced 3D technology. So be very careful who you talk to and what you say to them, because you're not secure. All right, we're going to take another quick break. Back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It's 40 minutes after the hour. It's Soundbites. It's member-supported. Jazz 90.1.
Before you call into our show, please make note of the following rules. 1. Turn your radio down. 2. Turn your radio down lower. 3. Remember, nobody has invented a good-sounding speakerphone yet. Don't use them. 4. Make sure you have a point. It makes for a more interesting show. 5. Calling does not guarantee you'll get on the air. No whining. 6. If you do get on the air, please do not tell the host what you just told the screener. We don't care. And 7. Is that radio turned down yet? We hope this will make for a more enjoyable program, and we thank you for your time.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 44 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites, and we have Tim from Webster, New York on the line. Welcome, Tim. What's up?
Yeah, hi, guys. Just kind of a fun question for you today, something I'm having trouble wrapping my mind around. I have a 500-gigabyte hard drive, and it's always been very near capacity, so over the couple of years now, I've spent a lot of time deleting, you know, putting in the recycle bin, large amount, a lot of content like videos and whatnot, probably to the tune of a couple hundred gigabytes. So my question is, apparently there are these services out there that are expensive that can help you retrieve things that you've deleted, and I'm wondering, how the heck is that possible? If I'm, you know, deleting so much, filling the hard drive back up and then deleting all this stuff and filling it back up.
Well, likely they can't.
They could only recover the last thing you deleted.
Right. Here's the deal on deletion. The way Windows works for delete, the way almost every operating system works for deletion, it doesn't actually delete anything. It simply marks those sectors as no longer full. As open, as free, even though there's stuff still in them, right? So what happens, here's the way a directory works. When you have a directory, there's really just a link to the first sector that's full. The first sector has a link to the second sector, et cetera, et cetera. And those are all marked as full. So what it does is it severs the links and marks them as empty, but it doesn't actually erase them. So on most hard drives, which are very, very open, right, the likelihood that you're overwriting stuff is fairly small. So you can generally go back and recall the last thing or two or even three that you've deleted. If someone's doing what you're doing, filling the drive, deleting stuff, filling the drive, deleting stuff, filling the drive, most of that old stuff is simply lost and cannot be retrieved. Now, that said, with the right equipment, you can, and not maybe back 2 years, but certainly fairly far back, you can detect the pattern that was underneath the current pattern.
So then, if I understand you right, there has to be actually a lot more than the 500 gigabytes, right?
No, it's just you take the book off the shelf and you can put another book there. But instead of taking the book off the shelf, you just tell the directory you can put another book there. And so the first file stays there on the hard drive until it's overwritten by the next file. And that's how the undelete works. The file is still on the hard drive until it's overwritten by another file.
Right. So to go to Steve's analogy, you've got this book, Huck Finn, and you decide you don't want Huck Finn anymore. So you tell your robot librarian, we don't want Huck Finn anymore. Instead of removing Huck Finn from the shelf, the librarian just remembers that Huck Finn is no longer important. So the next time it has to shelve a book, that's when it will go down the aisle, pull Huck Finn and throw it away, and put the new book in its place.
But in the meantime, someone could come along and say, what's in this spot on the hard drive? And the last thing that was there is still there and can be retrieved.
Right.
Okay, I basically get it.
And you still only have the same number, the same shelf space for books.
Okay.
You just pretend that some of the books are missing until you actually need that space, then you throw the books away.
And at which point you can't retrieve it, period.
Pretty much. Like I said, with the right very, 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 very expensive equipment, you can discern the underlying pattern from that's underneath the new set of magnetic patterns
and often
for the new file. But tricky and unlikely.
Yeah, costly, and you're not going to find it in your local store.
Oftentimes there's overlap. So you got a 100K file that you delete, and then you put a 50K file on it. Well, now there's 50K of the first file still there. Well, then you put a 60K file on it. Well, that might go into another spot and not fit in that 50K spot. So that 50K spot of the first file is still there waiting to be used until another 50K file is needed.
Or a 40 and a 10, or a 30 and a 20.
And that goes back to a previous thing we used to call disk fragmentation, where a single file could be stored in many spots around the disk wherever there happened to be a little hole for it to fit. But that made everything slower because it had to go find all those little pieces. So the modern operating systems don't let the files get fragmented by not splitting them into multiple pieces on the hard drive.
As much as possible.
As much as possible,
wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Wow.
And the hard drives are so fast these days, even if the file is fragmented, you don't notice it.
Yeah, right.
It's funny you brought that up. I was thinking of doing a defrag today. I haven't done one in a long time.
Yeah, with NTFS and the Max HFS Plus, you pretty much don't need to do a defrag.
Yeah, that's something back in the old FAT table days you had to. But once NTFS came along with XP and that, you no longer need to do that.
Oh, wow. Okay, that's great. Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks so much for your time, guys. Have a happy holiday.
Merry Christmas.
You too,
thanks.
Jim.
Yep, you too.
So, yeah. Excuse me. People have been in this community for a long time. Remember some of those old things.
Yeah.
I knew a guy that would defragment his drive every week because it ran noticeably faster after a defrag.
Right. This is somebody who obviously adds and removes files like Tim.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, that's where that Revo uninstaller is a great one
for doing applications.
Yeah.
Yeah. But most people just have tiny files that barely fill their terabyte hard drive these days, unless you do video. You know, and typically video is much larger and can fill your hard drives.
In fact,
we were talking with a customer this morning. He's got six Pegasus RAIDs what are they? They're like 16 terabytes each. Because he's a video producer. Most of the TV...
And he fills that daily.
Yeah.
Most of the commercials you see on Rochester Television are done by him.
Yep.
And so they use them to death, and he buys them all the time because they're just so useful to have that much disk space.
Yeah, and I have a friend who's a writer, and I helped him set up a system so it backs up and it does all this stuff. And he was asking me about fragmentation. I was telling him all this. And then I said, besides which, how often do you delete a file? And he actually got insulted. He said, never. Because he's a writer. He keeps everything he's written. I said, you don't have you don't have fragmentation.
Yeah.
You know, you've been just laying down file after file after file.
Yeah. Yeah.
And until you erase something, you don't even have the choice of fragmentation.
Mm-hmm.
That's one thing about buying a very large hard drive is you have to buy two. One for your data and one for your backup.
Yeah, right, exactly. but we've got him backed up all over the place. That's easy enough. And because it's his livelihood, he's paying for some online storage and et cetera, et cetera. But The days of the defragging and a lot of the old things we used to have to do, we don't have to do anymore.
Mm-hmm.
We really don't have to defragment anything anymore. Who cares? Even if you add and remove a lot of files nowadays, the operating systems themselves take care of that to a certain extent. You may find that once every year or 2 years, depending on your usage, defragmentation could help speed it up a little bit. But a little bit, not a great deal.
Remember the days, now this is going way back, you had to break up a hard drive in 20 gig partitions?
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. I remember meg partitions in the early days.
Yep.
Yeah.
I remember doubling the speed of my hard drive by adding a small extra hard drive for the temp files.
Yep.
Remember Interleave?
The simple fact that I used a separate drive for temp and it wasn't on the same IDE chain
right.
as my main drive meant that everything doubled in speed.
Yep. Cash it out to something else.
Yep. Yep. And I know people who did that. They bought essentially a giant, what we would now think of as an SSD card, right? A solid-state drive. Mm-hmm. It was just a giant RAM card that they used for their temp drive because you didn't trust it. I mean, because it was real RAM, so you know when you turn the machine off, it was gone. But for your temp files, it was perfect.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would buy one of those and use it for their temp drive, and that was kind of the forerunner of SSD cards, but... that speeded up machines incredibly.
Yep.
The hard drive is 50 years old and has gone through incredible changes over those 50 years. You know, I'm just trying to look. The first hard drive was you know like 1 megabyte and was the size of a room. And now we've got you know multi terabyte drives that fit in your shirt pocket.
I saw a picture of a 1 gigabyte drive being loaded onto an airplane with a crane.
Yep.
And it was one of those big C whatever it is transports, you know, loading it in the back there and loading it up. All right, I beg your pardon.
The first hard drive had 50 24-inch platters and was 3 megabytes.
Yep, exactly. Those are some great numbers. Listen, we're done for another week. I want to thank all of you who called in. I apologize to those of you to whom we did not get. Please call in earlier next week. We're done for another week. I want to extend for both Dave Enright and Steve Ray, as well as myself, please have a merry and safe Christmas and a terrific New Year and a happy Hanukkah and a joyous Kwanzaa and whatever you celebrate and however you celebrate it. Do it safely and peacefully, please. Don't go away. George is coming in to play the best German music you'll hear all week. We're done until after Christmas. See you next week at the longest-running computer show in the known universe, Soundbites, on member-supported Jazz 90.1.